Hello and welcome back to the Cool Your Jets podcast. I am Michael Nania. It is February 23rd, 2026, 11:09 a.m. as I record this, which means we are 3 days away from the beginning of the 2026 Combine drills. Of course, the Jets and Jets fans will be keeping a close eye on that, with the Jets having four top 45 picks in this year's draft. Plenty of Combine storylines to get into. Free agency is on the horizon. We're 2 weeks away from the start of legal tampering. That's on March 9th. So a lot of that to talk about. I've done a ton of free agent related articles recently, so I've been getting into the weeds on that. So I'd like to talk about some of those topics that I've been diving into. So let's just get into it. You know, we've reached sort of a lull here in the news cycle. After the conclusion of the regular season, we had a month of coaching drama. Who's the new defensive coordinator? Then offensive coordinator got thrown into that. And the process dragged on and on into, you know, almost mid-February. So that was keeping us fed for a while, but not much going on right now outside of the tag window opening up for players across the league, but for the Jets, Breece Hall being the obvious candidate there. That was last week, so that happened, and as of right now, there is no news regarding Breece Hall. Some comments that he made in social media activity, but nothing too major. So, yeah, I think this podcast we can kind of focus on some combine expectations, free agency expectations, storylines for both of those, and just kind of prepare ourselves for those two things. And, you know, this is one of the more fun parts of the calendar year. As a Jets fan, nothing but possibilities and hope and expectations. Generally, they have a lot of assets at this point, which they do this year. The cap space, top five in that. Varying numbers on the cap space. Right now, it's at $79 million at over the cap. And then looking at the SpotTrack cap space, they have the Jets at 77.8. So they're close now. It was a little more separated recently, but top five in cap space is the bottom line. Plenty of spending power, draft picks, four top 45 selections. You know the drill. It's fun at this time of year because the Jets are going to add all these amazing players and they're going to win the Super Bowl. So let's map out the plan to get there. I guess let's start with the combine because that is more imminent than free agency. And the Jets, of course, with their wide collection of premium picks, are going to have a lot of things to keep an eye on this week. So I did an article today, five things the Jets will be watching closely at the 2026 Combine. Check that out at JetX if you want to go into it even deeper, but I will get into some of those here today. So number one, as it pertains to this number two overall pick for the Jets, Reuben Baines' arm length. This is going to be a big one because he is squarely in that conversation to be chosen second overall defensive end out of Miami. Dominant season of production this past year as a true junior. 9.5 sacks, 15.5 tackles for loss, 83 total pressures. Got to the national championship game and was great in that game. So the production is obviously there. He's young. He's got the build you like from a height and weight standpoint. He's explosive. He's strong. He's got the complete package. The one thing that people are concerned about, or not the one thing, but I would say the most prominent concern is his arm length. And obviously at this point in the draft cycle each year, it's more of a, you know, a theory. It's based on film. And you could see, you know, if a guy has short arms or if it's an issue for him or his hands are too small or his height or whatever. But we don't have official measurements on these things until the combine. So for Bane, it's going to be a big one because we've seen arm length be a huge factor in where edge rushers get drafted. It was 2022 when Trayvon Walker, with his perfect RAS score and his 35-inch arms, got drafted over Aiden Hutchinson because his arms were pretty short. But, you know, Hutchinson was clearly the more productive player and he had great athleticism in his own right. But it was Walker who got drafted earlier, and that arm length was a big part of it. So teams do value this in terms of where players get stacked up. Now, how much does it matter? That's subjective. some people are a little more adhered to these benchmarks. Some people don't care at all. That's still up in the air, but does it matter in terms of where players get drafted? There's a lot of evidence to suggest that it does. So for Reuben Bain, his arm length is going to be critical. There's a lot of speculation he's going to measure at 31 inches. And, you know, that's pretty short for an edge rusher, to put it lightly, because I just brought up Aiden Hutchinson. And 2022, when he measured at 32 and an eighth, that was a major storyline. And like I just said, that's probably why the Jaguars took Walker over him, or at least a big part of it. That was at the eighth percentile among edge rushers at 32 and one eighth. So if Bain is over a full inch under that, we're talking extremely short arms for the edge position, especially for a guy who, you know, we're not talking about a 6'3", 250 pound speed rusher, 3'4" outside linebacker type. He's, you know, going to be having his hand in the dirt as a 4'3" defensive end, wherever he ends up. You know, if he lands with the Jets, I would assume that's how he would be used, as a 5-tech, hand in the dirt. So at 6'3 and 275, handling that type of responsibility with 31-inch arms, it's definitely could be a detriment. It doesn't completely write him off. There have been plenty of successful short-armed players, but even your Aiden Hutchinsons and your Terrell Suggs, who had 32-inch arms, even those guys had over a full inch on 31. So we'll see where he ends up. If he can get up to that 32-inch area, then I think you feel pretty good about his potential, because there are plenty of players in that range that have overcome the arm length to be successful. But at 31, we're talking about Bain having to be a major outlier to be successful. And that's not to say he's incapable of doing it, but you know, at the top of the draft, especially for the Jets, you're picking second overall. You want to feel great about that pick, about the safety of it, in terms of how likely is this player to at least be very good. And there's just not a lot of precedence for 31-inch edge rushers with 31-inch arms being successful in the league, at least to a, you know, star caliber degree. So that's a big one to keep an eye on. We'll see how that plays out for him. And Jordan Tyson, I think, is another very interesting player to watch for the Jets. He's now on the consensus mock draft, the favorite to go to the Jets at the 16th overall pick. At right now, he's about 23% as of the past week, 23% of mocks pegging him to the Jets. This is from NFL mock draft database. So he's squarely in that conversation, and he's polarizing. You know, there are people who love him. I've seen him go fifth in mock drafts. I've seen him go in the 20s. So opinions are all over the map. He's got a spotty injury history. He has that unique profile where his production peak was not his most recent season. That was in 2024, when he really put himself on the map as a top prospect. And this past season, his production declined. And part of that was hamstring injury late in the season, that he missed three games and then came back, wasn't as productive. So he's a guy who the combine can have a huge effect on his stock going into the draft. You know, this is an opportunity for him to not only show that he's healthy, but put together a dominant performance and show that, hey, he is one of the premier receiver prospects in this draft and a unique talent with superstar level ability at the NFL. Especially for a guy like him, it's, you know, the separation, the quickness that people rave about. So the combine for that type of player is really an opportunity to stand out and crush some of these drills and, you know, put it on paper in this very stable environment that the combine is, that you are superior as an athlete to not just receivers in this class, but receivers across recent history. So he could skyrocket after the combine. He could tumble, because, you know, if he doesn't look healthy, if he doesn't stand out, then teams are going to buy into those red flags about his injuries, about the declined production this past year. So the Jets at number 16 are in an interesting spot regarding him, because if he does well, I would think he probably won't even get to 16, at which point the Jets could trade up for him if they love him. They have the assets to execute a trade up if there's a prospect they absolutely love. They have the desperation for a receiver. They're probably going to choose a defensive player second. So there could be that setup where Tyson's stock rises. He's in the teens, around top 10. Jets trade up. That's in play. But then if his stock drops and he is available at 16, then the Jets have to weigh the risk reward of, do we believe in the ceiling enough to overlook the injuries and the other concerns regarding him? So Tyson is another very interesting player for the Jets to keep an eye on. Someone who I think what he does in Indianapolis will have a direct effect on how the Jets view him and ultimately the decision the Jets will make with that 16th overall pick. Next one here that I'm keeping an eye on, that would be the top prospects. You know, all the top non-quarterbacks who could be in the conversation for the Jets at number two. The edge rushers, Reuben Bain, David Bailey, Arvell Reese. Carnell Tate at wide receiver, I think, should be in that mix. And then Caleb Downs, a guy who, that's another topic. Actually, we can get into that after we get through this. I think that's a good topic to talk about. It was, I had an article about it. There are differing opinions on that. And it's a controversial subject. So I think we can talk about Downs a little bit after we get through this combine preview. But Downs is someone who a lot of people have in that mix. So there are quite a few players who have a legitimate chance to be drafted by the Jets at number two. So the combine is a great opportunity to see who can separate themselves from the pack. And, you know, you never want to overreact to the combine in either direction, whether someone does great or whether they do poorly. You don't want to read into it too much and have it overweigh what we know right now, which is, you know, how good did they play football in college? Pretty much as simple as that. Because once the combine happens, then there's all this other information that's going to get tossed into the pot, and none of it is based on them playing football games. So where we are right now, it's very important to keep this in mind over the next 2 months, right here on February 23rd, because at this point, there have been no pro days, there has been no combine, no meetings, none of that. Right now, it's just about how you played football games in college. And that's ultimately what matters, because you're getting drafted to win football games, not to run fast in a 40-yard line, not to crush meetings, not to make beautiful throws at pro days, none of that, to win football games. And right now, that is all we have. So that's an important thing to keep in mind. But at the same time, when you're the Jets and you have, I think, I would say five guys in here who are all similarly in play for this second overall pick, none of them clearly separating from the pack between Reese, Bain, Bailey, Tate, and Downs. And everyone has different opinions on that, but I throw all five of those names in there because between everyone's opinions, I think there's some combination of those five guys. So that's kind of the consensus top five right there. So between them, you know, maybe the Jets do have a clear-cut favorite. Maybe they don't, but the combine could be an opportunity to see who separates themselves from the pack. Is one of these guys a significantly more outstanding athlete than the rest? And, you know, that could be your tiebreaker of sorts. It doesn't override the film and the production that we have to this point, but if you're close on these guys, it might be a good bet to go with the player who has the more favorable athletic profile. So that is something to keep an eye on, which one of these top guys is going to really assert themselves, especially among those five players. Moving on here, another thing that I think is critical when watching the combine, while, you know, we just talked about identifying players who perform well at the combine and using that as potentially a tool to draft someone higher, but I think it's important to also take stock of which players may kind of establish themselves as players to avoid because they performed well at the combine. We see it all the time. Guys perform well at the combine and they shoot up the mock drafts, and then draft day comes and they do go higher in the draft or even higher than what the mock drafts project. I think a great example of this was John Ross from Washington back in 2017. Breaks the 40-yard dash record with his 4.22. And the Bengals take him 9th overall. And it's a stretch to say it was only because of that, but the history is tracked at NFL Mock Draft Database. They have the overall prospect rankings by date. So if you look back through Ross's profile, he was number 34 overall on the consensus big board before the combine. Then he gets drafted 9th. That's a 25-spot jump from an early second-round pick to a top 10 pick, which we're talking about millions and millions of dollars of cap space and salary and a whole round value of, you know, your draft capital. And that's pretty much solely based on that increase right there. You know, we're not saying he was a slouch of a prospect. You know, he was still viewed as an early second rounder, which is among the 7 rounds of the draft, makes you a very good prospect. So that's not to say he was projected to go in the 7th round and be a total bust, but he wasn't viewed as a surefire first round pick, then runs a 4.22, and now he's going top 10. And obviously he did not have the greatest career, to say the least. And again, like, you couldn't have projected he was going to struggle as much as he did. He didn't even get 1,000 yards for his entire career. So that's hard to project, but still, the Bengals reached because the guy ran a fast 40. And then to go back to the Trayvon Walker versus Aiden Hutchinson debacle of 2022, I call it a debacle because even at the time, I could not fathom why the Jaguars did that, and the results panned out as they did, or at least as they have to this point. So to go back to that, you have another guy in Trayvon Walker who lights it up at the combine. He's got the measurements, everything on paper that you want to see, except the football production. He was not productive in college. He was like an average at best college player. And relative to draft prospects, especially first rounders, he was bad. If you stack up the way he performed against all first round picks, and I'm saying all first round picks, not just number one, not just top 10, all first round picks, he's among the worst first rounders to be drafted over the last 10 years in terms of how they produced in their last college season. Aiden Hutchinson was one of the best. And which one of these two guys has been dominant in the NFL? The guy who was good at football in college. Now, there are exceptions to this rule. Sometimes guys aren't great in college and they have potential and they pan out in the league. Sometimes they are great and they bomb in the NFL. So there is no hard rule. But for edge rushers specifically, and I did an article on this that it's linked in the Combine article that I posted today, but you can find that one as well if you just search edge rushers, Jets X Factor, Michael Nania, something like that. But I did an article analyzing, comparing the core. I think we talked about it on here, comparing the correlation between final season college production and future NFL production. And for edge rushers, it's really, really strong. A lot more than just about any other position. And I think, like we talked about, it's because it's very stable to predict. You know, scheme doesn't matter quite as much as a quarterback, as a receiver, even a corner. It's just beat the guy in front of you. So if you're doing it at a high level in college, there's a pretty good chance you're going to do it in the NFL. It's not guaranteed. And it's also not guaranteed you'll fail if you weren't doing that in college. But there is a strong trend that you are a lot likelier to succeed based on your production than, you know, you're a lot likelier to succeed if you were productive than if you weren't, simply put, especially for edge rushers. So all of that is to say, as we watch the combine, it's important to keep note of, okay, what did we think of these guys before they took the field in Indianapolis? And if suddenly in mid-March, players are getting mocked 20 spots higher than they were today on February 23rd, that's a red flag to me. And I think you should be wary of that, and that the Jets should. So as much as you want to, you know, take stock, who lit up the combine and are there good trends attached to high 40 times, high RAS scores, all that stuff, it's important to be cognizant of how good did these guys play football in college. simply put. And right now, that's all we have on February 23rd. So keep stock of this and just keep note of whose stock gets out of hand just because of the combine. And be wary of those players. And just be sure to double check, you know, is there something on film we missed? You know, this guy ran a 4.25, but we didn't really think much of him 2 weeks ago. Can we actually see that speed on his film, or is it just combine speed that doesn't translate to football speed? I think that's really important to keep an eye on. So be wary of the skyrocketing prospects from the combine. And then on the other side of that, identify the guys who could be steals because of the combine. Sometimes, you know, the opposite effect is that a player was really good at football, they bomb the combine, and then their stock plummets, but someone picks them up later than expected, and they get a steal because the guy can play football, and it doesn't matter what his three-cone time is. So there are plenty of great examples of this as well. Terrell Suggs, I think, is one of the best. He had the single-season sack record back in 2002, 24 sacks at Arizona State. He was only in his third year. He was 20 years old going into the draft cycle. Stunk up the combine, 476 RAS score, 32-inch arms. So he goes 10th overall. So he didn't completely plummet, but 10th overall for an edge rusher who had 24 sacks in the Pac-12, I believe it was at the time, is pretty low. So the Ravens benefited from that. Obviously, Suggs had a tremendous career, 132.5 sacks for them, and he was immediately productive too. 12 sacks, defensive rookie of the year. So he's one of the best examples of that. But the Jets last year had an example of this, taking Azaria Thomas in the third round. Going into the draft, he was kind of viewed as early second round. Some people even said late first. Number 40 was his overall big board or consensus ranking going into the combine. But then he runs a 4.58 in the 40. And by draft day, he was number 52. So he had dropped 12 spots on the big board post-combine. And then he goes even later than that. The Jets take him 73rd overall in the third. And obviously, the jury's still out on him. But 21-year-old Berkey Corner had a really solid year. 48% completion rate allowed. The game he had against the Bengals was tremendous. Obviously, he had the hiccup. He gave up a touchdown. But overall, really promising. He had a 6-game streak that's still active of games with at least one pass defended, and that's already tied for the 6th best in Jets history for any player, not just for rookies. And he can extend that if he keeps it going at the start of next season. The only guys above that, Darrell Revis and Aaron Glenn, actually, are tied for the record with 8. Then DJ Reed, Sauce Gardner, and Revis again had 7 apiece. Then it's Azaria Thomas with his active 6-game streak with at least one pass deflection. And this is a guy who ran a 4.58. So those players you also have to look out for at the combine. It's not as black and white as, okay, good combine performance, thumbs up. We want him. Bad combine performance, thumbs down. Stay away from him. Combine evaluation is not that black and white. I think you also want to look for the next Azaria Thomas or Terrell Suggs, a guy who goes to the combine, doesn't perform well, and his stock drops because, you know, naturally that's going to happen. This is an opportunity to watch all of these prospects on this, you know, on a similar plane, all in the same spot. So naturally, if they perform poorly, people are going to be lower on them. If they perform well, people are going to be higher. That's just human nature. But I think it's important to look at it from a wider scope and take into account, okay, if this guy performs well or doesn't perform well, it doesn't necessarily mean that he's a bad football player. It could mean that we can steal this guy later in the draft than his talent justifies just because the combine caused him to drop. So keep an eye out for those players as well. Who are the good football players? They're productive in college. They have good film, maybe even good measurables, even if they don't perform well in the drills, but length and height, like those are things that Thomas had. He has great size, great arm length, just didn't run well in the 40. And there were other drills he was mediocre in as well. So it wasn't just the 40, but he did have the measurables. So keep an eye on that. Who has a good football profile but performs poorly in the combine and his stock drops? And now the Jets have an opportunity to draft this guy much later than he really should be if we're just going on his football ability. So I would say those are the top five things I'm looking out for at the combine. So to recap, Reuben Bain's arm length is going to be huge. Can anyone separate themselves among the top prospects? Jordan Tyson's performance is going to be key. And then which workout warriors should you stay away from? And which combine fallers should you be appealed by the potential of taking them later? So I would say those are the top five things that I'll be looking out for at the combine. And I think the Jets should and will be as well. All right, Caleb Downs, let's get into it. I personally think the Jets should not even consider drafting him second overall. And let's get into it. First and foremost, this has nothing to do with his talent or his ability. He's tremendous. He's the complete package. And if you want to peg him as the greatest safety prospect of the past 5 years, 10 years, whatever, I think it's fair. It comes down to positional value. I just don't think a safety can justify the second overall pick. And this would be different if it were even just four slots later, like sixth overall pick. But at number two, where the Jets have a chance to take the first non-quarterback of the draft, there's a tremendous crop of edge rushers to choose from, an elite wide receiver in Carnell Tate. It's just not a situation where it makes sense to me. Maybe it would be different if this was, let's say the edge rush class did not have great talent at the top. Same for receiver. And the other top prospects were, let's say, offensive tackles or, you know, defensive tackles. Although even defensive tackle, I might take over them. But bottom line, there are great edge rushers available here, which is maybe the most important non-quarterback position. And I think wide receiver is either similar or right behind edge rusher. And you got a blue chip receiver there too in Carnell Tate. So it's not like this is a situation where... So even if you think Downs is a better safety than any of those players are at their positions, Reese, Bain, Bailey, and Tate, it's not a wide enough gap to where the positional value is tossed aside. You know, I would agree that he is a better safety prospect than any of those other players are at their respective positions, but it's just not wide enough of a gap for me to overlook the fact that safety just isn't as valuable as those positions. Because those guys are amazing in their own right. Even if none of them are the best prospect at their position of the last 10 years, the same way that Downs is, edge and wide receiver are far enough ahead of safety and value for me. And this is subjective. So if people see it differently, I completely understand it. But for me, those positions are far enough ahead in value that Downs being a little bit better as a safety than those guys are at their positions just doesn't justify the pick for me. And maybe a little isn't putting it strong enough, because again, best safety the last 10 years, 15, whatever. Sure, I think you can make that argument. And you can't for those other players at their positions. But I still think they're elite prospects. All three of those edge rushers, I really feel confident about them being having a high floor, a high likelihood of being at least good players, but also a high ceiling of potentially being among the best in the league. And this Carnell Tate, I feel really good about. I think there's a very good chance he's going to be a Jaxon Smith-Njigba, Ja'Marr Chase type player. His profile is right on par with them in key metrics that correlate with college. So I'm not talking about receiving yards, receiving touchdowns, how tall he is, or any of those things. Specifically in metrics, and I think we talked about this on the podcast as well, but I also did an article on wide receiver prospects and which college metrics correlate the most with NFL success. And in those top metrics that correlate the most with NFL success, he's right on par with Smith-Njigba, Chase, these guys who had some of the best profiles coming out of college and then went on to be successful in the NFL. So I really believe in him. So sure, none of these guys are the best edge or receiver the past 10 years, but they play premium positions and they're blue chip prospects. They justify the second overall pick. I don't think there's enough of a gap for safety to be worth it. Would it be different if the edge, the top of the edge and receiver classes weren't as good and this was like an offensive tackle heavy top of the draft? Maybe I would see the argument, but let me get into the two reasons why I think a safety does not justify the second overall pick. So first, you have to look at it from a salary cap perspective. All of these guys are going to get the same salary from the Jets at the second overall pick, regardless of their position. But when you consider that these positions have different values across the league, that means a safety is going to be a worse value than the other positions. So the number two pick, according to SpotTrack, is projected to get a four-year, $52.5 million deal. That's a $13.1 million salary, and the first-year cap hit is $9.3 million. For safeties, that would immediately make downs, based on current contracts right now, this will change with free agency, but right now, that would make downs the 13th highest paid safety in terms of salary, 17th in terms of 2026 cap hit. Compare that to edge rushers, 25th in salary, 33rd in cap hit. Wide receivers, 28th in salary, 34th in cap hit. That's a massive discrepancy. So you're talking about downs being immediately paid as like a top end above average starter versus an edge or a receiver. You're getting 4 years of him being paid as an average middle of the line type player at his position. And those ranks will go down across the rookie contract. So you're talking year four, if this guy's a great starter, and you know, a contract extension will be in there at some point, but year three, year four, you could have one of the best players in the league at a premium position for a below league average starter salary. That is a massive potential net value for your team versus a safety. You know, you're paying him immediately as a top end starter. And obviously you think there's a good chance that Downs is going to play up to that, but there's just so much more potential value to be gained by targeting a player who will be paid the same salary but plays a position that typically costs more. To me, it's a really simple calculation in that way. So I think a good way to put this is by looking at it through the lens of the player you don't, or the position you don't draft here with the second pick. You're going to have to go get a veteran starter to replace that. So say the Jets take Downs second, and he has that $9.3 million cap hit in year one. So then the Jets have to go get, and again, this is just a placeholder analysis. There are a number of different ways you could actually fill the hole, but just for the sake of exemplifying this, then the Jets would have to get a league average free agent starter to fill the edge rusher's spot. Like, let's say it's Arvell Reese. So to fill Reese's spot, you're going to sign an average veteran free agent. Right now, the 32nd ranked cap hit at edge is $10.1 million. So if you take Downs, you combine him with the average veteran free agent who replaces Reese, that's $19.4 million in cap hit. Now let's say you take Reese with that pick, same $9.3 million, but now you have to fill Downs' shoes at safety. And that's significantly cheaper than the veteran replacement that you have to get on the edge. Right now, the 32nd ranked cap hit at the safety position is only $3.9 million. Combine that with 9.3, $13.1 million between the two positions, compared to 19.4 if you take Downs. That's a $6.3 million difference just in cap hit for this year. You can get a whole extra starter with that money. You can get two solid backups, or like, you know, high-end backup, low-end starter type players. That's not nothing. And, you know, that's how you win in the NFL, is through this type of roster construction, just considering the value of each dollar and building out the best group of 53 that you can. I think the Seahawks this year are a great example. This team, you know, they won 9 to 10 games a year the last 3 years, returned a lot of the same core, but I think what built them up to being a championship contender is how complete their roster is. Offense and defense, rush defense and pass defense, rush offense and pass offense, and throw it all the way to special teams where they had a dominant special teams, close to as good as the Jets' special teams was. Their roster is so complete. Like the top end talent, there's not a, you know, they have a lot of great players, but besides JSN, not really household name, megastar, future Hall of Fame players. And again, I'm not taking away from the great players, the Pro Bowls, Pro Bowlers and all pros that they have. But, you know, no one projected much from the Seahawks coming into the year. And we knew Devin Witherspoon was good. Leonard Williams, DeMarcus Lawrence, Kenneth Walker, all these players that they have on their roster. We knew they were good, but it's the completeness that made them so good. And you can only get that by allocating your cap space in a smart way. And taking a safety at number two is not doing that. So for me, I'm very much opposed to the idea of, you know, taking a non-premium position with a premium draft pick and then leaving the premium positions to be filled with more expensive veterans. And, you know, maybe the Jets take an edge rusher 16th or with the early round pick. So it doesn't necessarily have to be that same model, but just the base logic of, okay, this player is going to get the same salary regardless. Let's take a player whose position generally makes less money. Doesn't make as much sense to me. And I think as you branch out and start picturing how the entire roster is going to be built around that selection, there's just so much more value to be had when you take advantage of the fact that you can get one of the most valuable positions in the league for a really cheap salary relative to what that position generally costs versus, you know, a position like safety that's one of the cheapest in the league and paying a premium salary there. So, you know, this is why quarterbacks always go so early and get forced earlier than their talent probably justifies, because quarterback is by far the most expensive position. And you take one of those at the top of the draft in the same slot where someone might take a safety, and your quarterback is an extreme bargain. And no other position comes close to the quarterback salary or as much of a bargain as that is. But after quarterback, edge and wide receiver are right there as some of the best positions to get value by taking advantage of the salary cap scaling system within the draft order. So yeah, that's number one reason for me is the salary aspect. But number two is, I think number two is the reason why safeties are valued the way they are from a salary cap aspect. But that's the fact that safeties in today's game just can't dominate games the way they used to. So I think a lot of people justify the idea of the Downs pick by, you know, they say he's one of the most talented safeties that we've ever seen coming out. And I won't disagree with that. So they'll compare him with guys like Ed Reed and Troy Polamalu and say, if he makes this type of impact, then it justifies the diminished positional value. It justifies taking him over an edge rusher, over a receiver. And you know what? If he were Ed Reed, if he were Troy Polamalu, sure, I would sign up for that. The problem is, those guys can't exist in the league today. There's just no such thing as that anymore. When was the last time a player has been that impactful at the safety position? And keep in mind the numbers that these guys put up that we're talking about. Ed Reed was routinely picking off 8 or 9 passes a season. Polamalu had some 7 interception years, and that wasn't even the basis of his game. It was how hard he could hit and how active he was along the line of scrimmage. So since then, like since their era, we're like the 2000s, early 2010s, the game is so different, and it has changed in a way that diminishes the value. The value of safeties, but just the general impact ceiling that they could have. So look at Kyle Hamilton, for example. Great player, best safety in the league, undoubtedly a huge asset for the Ravens. But this past season, he was a first-team All-Pro. Here are some of the numbers he had. 0 interceptions, 0 fumble recoveries, 1 sack, 2 forced fumbles, 7 tackles for loss, 9 pass deflections, 105 tackles, and three touchdowns allowed in coverage. So, look, those are box score stats. I know if you look at other things like his coverage metrics and his PFF grades, he's elite and it's justified. You know, you watch him, he's great. But at the end of the day, second overall pick and also first non-quarterback of this draft, I think you should want someone who has a more omnipresent impact than those numbers I just read off for you. This is the cream of the crop of the safety position. First team all pro, unanimously the best safety in the league right now. He did not pick off a single pass. He did not recover a single fumble. He had one sack, and he knocked two fumbles out. If that's the best we can do at safety right now, I don't want that position with the second overall pick. So even if Downs is as talented as Hamilton, or even a little bit more, you know, there's just not a lot of room for safeties to do a lot of damage in today's league, and it's because of the way the game has changed. So I'll give you a couple numbers that represent this. But in 2003, this was Ed Reed's second NFL season, the league average interception rate was 3.3%. So that's 3.3% of passes that were picked off. 2025, it had dropped to 2.2%, a record low. That's two-thirds of where it was in Ed Reed's second NFL season. So 2003, we're talking one pick every 31 passes. So it's basically at least one a game that's being thrown by every quarterback. This past season, one pick every 46 passes, 15 more passes it takes to get to the next interception. And that's less than one a game for most quarterbacks. So the interception ceiling, like if that's your basis of why you should take Downs, that he's a great ball hawk, he's going to get all these interceptions for you. The reality is just it's probably not going to happen because even the most talented safeties in the game today just can't consistently get interceptions. And there are fluke years where someone will get, you know, seven, whatever it may be, but then they just drop right down because it's not something a safety has the ability to do consistently because interceptions are disappearing. Teams are playing more cover two. Offenses are getting, in response to that, offenses are getting the ball out quicker, shallower. And I think analytically influenced, they're playing higher completion percentage type of offense to avoid interceptions. So interceptions are disappearing, and it's becoming really difficult for even the most talented players to control getting interceptions. When Ed Reed was in his prime, teams were taking shots down the field all day long. There was more man coverage, more single high, and all of that equated to a guy like Ed Reed. You trusted he was going to get his 7 to 9 interceptions every year because the opportunities were going to be there. And since he was so talented, he was going to capitalize on those. But now, even if you are really talented, it's difficult to get that every single year. Like, look at Derwin James, another tremendous safety, one of the best in the league since he was drafted. Here are his interception totals in his career. 3-0-2-2-1-1-3. And this is Derwin James, probably, if not the best safety in the league since he came in, top two or three, and a guy who's extremely athletic. And even he can't really get more than an interception or two a season. So, like, it's not that safety doesn't matter. It obviously does. But they can't dominate games to the extent of a receiver who every single game, there's nothing you could do about him getting 100 yards and a touchdown, or an edge rusher who every single game gets a sack and he gets strip sacks and he gets three tackles for loss. And if you want to stop him from doing those things, you have to double team him, at which point everyone else on the team becomes better. And the same thing for receivers. If you want to stop him from getting those numbers, you double team him. Now everyone else is better. So that just adds to those positions' value because in order to stop them, you have to allocate resources to them as the opponent. And that makes life even harder for you because now everyone else becomes harder to stop. Safeties aren't like that. You don't allocate resources to a safety. They're on the back end of the defense. They're the last line of defense. There's no one-on-one matchup that they're consistently involved in. You don't double team them. You don't really adjust your game plan to avoid them. They're just kind of a cog in the machine. They need to play their role, and that's where their impact comes from. And it could be a huge impact if they're like a Kyle Hamilton or a Derwin James. They consistently make their tackles. They win their assignments and coverage when they come, but they're just not as much of a focal point as edge rushers and receivers are. Those positions are just as impactful as ever. You know, receivers break records every single year with yards and things like that. Edge rushers still breaking sack records. The league average sacks per game this past season was higher than 20 years ago, higher than 30 years ago. So the avenues for safeties to make game-changing plays, I'm not saying they don't affect the game, but second overall pick, I feel like you want a player who can win games on his own. He can be the reason that you win games every single week. And I just think edge rushers and wide receivers have a much, much better chance of doing that than safeties. And it's not because Downs isn't good. It's because I just don't think the game is played in a way where safeties get as many opportunities to make those game-changing plays. Teams aren't playing as much single high coverage, and offenses aren't taking as many shots down the field that would give safeties chances to make plays. And then even in the downhill aspect of the safety position, the tackling and the hitting, that's getting diminished as well because rule changes are discouraging those crushing hits that made Troy Polamalu and all of those great safeties of, you know, the early 21st century, that made all those guys so popular and so impactful. You can't do that anymore. The rules are discouraging you from doing it. So all of that is to say, I'm not claiming safety isn't important, but number two overall, if I have a chance to get an elite edge rusher or wide receiver, even if they're a little less elite at their position than the safety is, I'm taking the edge or wide receiver every single time. Every time. I think the 10th to 15th best wide receiver has more impact than the best safety. I really do. Maybe that's a hot take, but the salaries in the league kind of line up with that. NFL teams are putting their money where their mouth is in regards to that claim. So, I mean, Garrett Wilson, look at his salary. You know, he's somewhere around the top 10, right? I'm going to pull it up right now so I can give you the facts. But, you know, Garrett Wilson is not, at least in terms of his production, has not been a top 5 to 10 receiver. But, okay, he's actually fifth right now, $32.5 million. But I'll give you the numbers here. So let's look at the safety salaries. Number one right now is Hamilton, 25.1. And that's way ahead of second place, 21.3 million. But if we go to wide receiver, to find a $25.1 million salary, you have to go all the way down to DeVonta Smith, who is the 15th highest paid receiver. So that aligns perfectly with what I just said. The number one safety gets paid as much as the 15th ranked wide receiver. So yeah, I just don't think safeties make a huge impact in today's game. I really don't. So I can't justify using the second pick, this being the Jets' best avenue to adding a franchise player, on a safety, a position that is the furthest away from the ball and rarely has shots taken in their direction. I don't think they could be as much of an anchor of a defensive turnaround as an edge rusher who makes his teammates better. You know, that's another big part of it, which I already alluded to, but you know, you take an edge rusher or a wide receiver, not only is that guy more consistently involved in making an impact and making game-changing plays, but he makes everyone around him better. And I don't think a safety does that to the same extent. And all of this is considering that Downs might be the best safety prospect in recent history. But even considering that, I just don't think he's going to affect the game as much as these other prospects. So there you go. That's my stance on Caleb Downs and the idea of taking him second overall. I understand the counter arguments and the different perspectives. Ultimately, analyzing the draft and really all of football philosophy in general, it's subjective. Everyone has different opinions. And I understand why people look at it differently and might have a different perspective than I do. But that's how I'm looking at it. And I would advise the Jets to look at it similarly. But other people have different opinions, and that's okay. That's what makes all of this fun and interesting to talk about. If it were extremely black and white and there were obvious right things to do, obvious wrong things to do, I wouldn't be doing hour-long podcasts pondering these things and you wouldn't be listening to my hour-long podcast pondering these things. So that is what makes football interesting, and I appreciate the fact that these debates can be had every single year. You know, there are new debates, new conversations, and I think that's really it's the most appealing part of doing this. You know, podcasts, writing, being in football media / coverage in general, is these like philosophical type debates. What wins? What facilitates winning? What are the best strategies? This is the stuff I love. So I appreciate the fact that football isn't an easy game to figure out. And there are so many different ways to go about it, philosophies that people have. I really enjoy that. So if you strongly disagree with my Caleb Downs take, that's good. That's what I love about football. So, and I'm glad to provide a different perspective for you to consider as well. And I appreciate all the outside perspectives making me think about it a little bit differently also. All right, let's talk a little bit about free agency. 2 weeks away from legal tampering. I'm sure we'll have another podcast getting into it a little more in depth, but let's touch on some topics here. Breece Hall, franchise tag, will it happen? Will he stick with the Jets? People have been talking about this for months now, and it's really now the main headline around the team. I'm very much on the fence with this one. Like, I don't think he's a must keep at all costs type of player. I think there's a line in the sand here. And I also don't think he's someone who's easily replaceable, and the Jets should just, you know, believe that any running back can do the same thing. I just did an analysis on this recently, but he ranked 7th among running backs last year in total yards over expected. That's combined between rushing yards over expected and receiving yards over expected, using tracking data to calculate, okay, how many yards should this player get based on the positioning of all the players on the field, the blocking, all that stuff. So he was 7th best among running backs in terms of his total yards created, and that accounts for his surroundings. So we're not in a place where it's like, okay, he'll be better without the Jets because the Jets support is terrible. No, everyone's evaluated on the same plane in this metric, great situation or bad. 7th best in the league last year in total yards above expected between both phases. So I think that's a good place to put Hall in terms of his ranking among running backs right now. 7th best, that's where I'm putting him for last year. And obviously he's young and he hasn't been in a great situation, so there is potential for him to be even better than that. So I think that is what the main variable is going to be for him, is whether there's a team out there, and if one of those teams is the Jets, that believes he will hit that higher level. Because I think everyone can agree he's capable of it because we've seen those flashes. But we are 4 years in, and he still hasn't quite had that season where he stayed healthy and was productive enough to be a Pro Bowler, an All-Pro, and dominate games at a Saquon, Derrick Henry, even Bijan Robinson type of level. I think we know he has that potential, but he hasn't done it yet. So the big factor in determining his value is whether you believe he will do that, especially if he gets to play in a better scheme. But I think metrics like the one I just brought up are important because it accounts for the surroundings and helps us get an accurate read of how impactful this player truly is while accounting for his surroundings. So I think 7th best is a good ballpark to put Breece Hall's impact in right now. And considering that, what should the Jets' decision be? I would look to extend him if you can get him for a price around, let's say, $10 to $11 million a year. His SpotTrack market value right now is pegged at about $10.5 million. So if the Jets can get him to sign on to a long-term deal for that, I would sign up for it. But would Breece Hall take that? That I don't know. So at that $10.4 million salary for Breece Hall, he would currently rank 9th among running backs. Does Breece Hall think he's the 9th best running back? I don't think so. But is that a fair value relative to his actual production right now? Yes, it is. Like I just said, 7th best last year in total yards over expected, 241, which is a great number. So that salary actually is really fair for the production that he's had. And in 2024, he was a lot worse. He's pretty mediocre. So we still don't even know if 2025 can be sustained. So if the Jets can get him to agree to that, I know Javonte Williams just signed for $8 million a year, 3 years, $24 million. And this past season, he was similarly productive to Hall. 1,300 yards from scrimmage, 13 touchdowns for Williams, and Breece Hall had a little over 1,400 yards and 5 touchdowns. But Hall has the more productive 3-year body of work than Williams. So he will make more than Javonte Williams, but the question is how much? And that's where the dilemma kind of comes in, and really always is for the running back position, because, you know, it's a devalued position. They don't make a ton of money compared to what they used to relative to the rest of the league. So I would try to get him to sign for that extension, but I don't think he's going to take it. And that probably leads you to, I think, the transition tag. So for the Jets, franchise tag for running backs expected to be $14.5 million. It wouldn't be the worst move in the world. I'm not saying I wouldn't do it, or the Jets should be knocked for it. But I do think $14.5 million is a bit much for Breece Hall. But, you know, if you want to keep him around for this year, you like his fit in your offense, but you also don't want to commit yet long term, it's understandable. And as opposed to the transition tag, you keep him around, you take away any possibility that he negotiates elsewhere. But the transition tag is $11.7 million, and I think that's a fair price for Breece on a 1-year price tag. And then, you know, you see what his market value is. Maybe he goes out there and he finds out he's not going to get more than that. And potentially working off of that, the Jets can sign him to an extension in that $11.7 million salary range, maybe $12 million a year. And I would say that's pretty fair for Breece Hall. And at the same time, you get a cheaper year one cap hit compared to the franchise tag. The risk is that he goes out there and finds out that he is worth $14 million a year. And that brings me back to the first point I made. Does someone out there believe Breece Hall will hit that ceiling of being Saquon, Derrick Henry? So if you transition tag him and there is a team out there that believes that, I think they will throw $14 million a year at him, maybe 15 even, to bet on that ceiling of a young running back with game-breaking speed and a high ceiling who hasn't played in a great offense yet. A team like the Chiefs, someone like that, who has the belief that their supporting cast will push him to 2,000 scrimmage yards, 15 touchdowns. So if you transition tag him, I think there's a good chance you lose him if someone out there believes in his price tag to that extent. But then at that point, you know, I don't think the Jets should be paying that much for Breece Hall in their current situation, given their needs at more valuable positions. So clearly I'm on the fence here and I don't have a you know, very firm take for you. They should do this, they shouldn't do that. But he's a very good player. We just don't know yet if he's elite. And, you know, for a non-premium position like running back, you know, we just talked about safety. I think running back is the offensive version of safety. For a non-premium position like that, if you're a rebuilding team, if you're going to commit a top-end salary to a player at that position, you better be sure he's one of those unique game breakers who truly changes everything for your team. And Breece Hall is really good, that's clear. But is he quite at that level to justify that salary for the Jets in their situation? That's the question I'm hung up on. But on the other side of the coin, I'm not just trying to kick him out the door either, because, like I said, seventh place in yards over expected, you don't replace that with any average running back. You could throw any average running back in there and he'll get 3 yards in a clouds of dust every time and, you know, do his job. But can he make the impact that Breece Hall did? That's not guaranteed. And you will save cap space. So maybe, you know, the team as a whole could be better by just going with cheap fourth round running backs. You know, the Jets have two running backs on their roster right now who are still on post first round rookie contracts. So, you know, or day three rookie contracts. So you take those two, add in another one, stay extremely cheap at the position, and use all of that extra cap space on an edge rusher, a receiver, whatever it may be. That could make the team better overall. I see that argument. But specifically at running back, I don't think it's that easy to replace the impact that Hall has. And that's why I think it is justified to extend him for 10, 11, maybe $12 million a year, use the transition tag. But once we start pushing up into that $14, $15 million range, that's where it gets a little iffy for me. So we'll see where the Jets land on this. I expect a transition tag. I think that's going to be the move. I don't get the sense that they're so committed to him that they're just going to franchise tag him or go ahead and give him whatever extension he wants. But I also don't think they're about to kick him to the curb either. I do think there is an appreciation there for his impact. So I would expect a transition tag, but we'll see what happens. There are some other free agency topics we can get into, but maybe I'll save some of those for a more free agency focused podcast next week. Once the combine is over, we can react to that a little bit and then get into free agency as that becomes the main topic of conversation. There are a few things that we can get into once we get to that point. And I've done some articles on it, so check those out. Go to my article page at JetX, and I talked about a couple safeties I think the Jets should target. I talked about the market values of all of their own impending free agents. I shot down a couple free agent corners who have been linked to the Jets recently and talked about why I don't think they make any sense. So check those out, and I'm sure we'll talk about those in more depth next week, but I'll stop it right about here. A lot about the combine that we talked about, got into Breece Hall, got into the big Caleb Downs debate. Combine's coming up this Thursday. It's going to be big for the Jets. We got a Breece Hall decision looming. We got free agency in 2 weeks. It's the best time of the year to be a Jets fan. This is the Christmas season of Jets fandom. I guess the draft is like Christmas, and then kind of starting with the combine, that's like the beginning of the Advent calendar, you know, and we get these little chocolates every single day, like a 40 time here, an arm length measurement there. Then you get to free agency. Here's a new starting, like wide receiver 3 for you. Here's a unknown defensive tackle who's actually really good at stuffing the run, and he's going to change everything for the defense. Here's a slot corner who's going to compete, and he's really feisty. These are all the little pieces we get, and then you get to draft day. That's Christmas Day, and you get your haul of presents. So we've reached Christmas season for Jets fans. Let's do it. Combine coming up this week. Thanks so much for listening. Talk to you next time.